Given the age of surveillance we're living in, and a fascination with dystopian novels, a timely book came out last year to mark the 70th anniversary of George Orwell's 1984. It's a book claimed by both the right and the left of politics, and unsurprisingly perhaps, its sales always increase during times of political turmoil. Journalist Dorian Lynskey is the author of the book, which is called The Ministry of Truth, a biography of George Orwell's 1984, published by Picador. And I began by asking Dorian, what got him interested in Orwell?
Well, I think with Orwell, he's one of those authors that it's sort of unremarkable to say that you've read him when you're young. It's kind of in your starter kit. I remember, you know, with books like Lord of the Flies and Clockwork Orange, Brave New World, 1984. And so that's, I think, how a lot of people come to him. And then it was later on in my 20s, really, so late teens, 20s, that I began to discover, you know, the essays, his whole kind of other nonfiction like Homage to Catalonia. It kind of expands and expands. And almost the older I got, the more that he resonated with me. And it kind of led me back to 1984. And I thought, okay, well, what did I not get about this when I was younger? And what perhaps, because it's so widely quoted by so many different people and misquoted as well, I thought, well, what are other people not getting, you know, that would make this book illuminating?
It's interesting that Christopher Hitchens, who was one of my very first guests and a regular on the program decades ago, said much the same thing when we were discussing all. He, like you, became absolutely entranced by the essays.
Well, there's a quote from Hitchens in my book where he says, Orwell says, the important thing is not what you think, but how you think. And that's very true. You don't have to agree with Orwell on everything. He was a very idiosyncratic man. You know, not everybody is going to agree with him on every aspect of his sort of values. But it was just the way that he was always being honest, and he was always looking for ways in which his own biases had led him astray. He's a very, very self-critical, extremely self-critical writer. And of course, hugely important, I think the most important concept in 1984, even though it's less famous than Big Brother or The Thought Police or Newspeak, is doublethink. And it's about how your own thinking betrays you. And what I really enjoyed about writing this book and going through his 20 volumes of his collected works, like every letter and list and film review and everything that basically he ever wrote that's available, was just seeing this mind constantly evolving and changing his mind as well, which I think is an underrated virtue.
Dorian, why did you decide to write a biography of 1984 rather than a biography of Orwell himself?
Well, I suppose I felt that, I mean, there have been a handful of books described as biographies of books, and I think the life of a book is very interesting. You know, it's obviously very, very much overlaps with the life of the author, but then it goes off and has a life of its own. And what intrigued me in this case is that Orwell died less than a year after 1984 came out. So almost his novel was like a baby, you know, at the time that he died. And I thought it would be a way of looking into his life, particularly the kind of the writings and the experiences that fed into 1984. But then I didn't have to stop once he died. I didn't have to just turn that into an epilogue, because there's some brilliant Orwell biographies, but inevitably his influence over the last 70 years is just in a little afterword. And I thought, well, no, let's really dig into this and see all the different ways in which the book has been inspired artists, but also been talked about by politicians, the way it's been abused and used. I thought that was another story.
Dorian, I mentioned Trump in dispatches, and it's hard to get through a program without talking Donald. Mm. And of course, when he took the White House, when Britain voted for Brexit and populism swept across Europe, people started talking seriously about the upheavals of the 70s and worse, the 30s. In other words, your timing for this is perfect.
And I don't think I really thought that through particularly. I came up with the idea in 2016, and I think probably after Brexit, although I didn't relate it to that, But before Trump was elected, and certainly before he took office, and the sales of 1984 on Amazon went up by almost 10,000%.
Sorry, you know, say that again. Went up by what?
Almost 10,000% in a couple of days.
Wow. And
I thought, you know, I already had the idea, and I was kind of trying to put together a proposal. And then I saw that and thought, oh, okay, right, I'm onto something here, because it was simply the phrase alternative facts. And there was obviously something deep in our sort of cultural memory that when you hear something like that, you think, oh, well, you think, I'd better read 1984. And clearly many, many people did.
And of course, the Hannah Arendt and all sorts of others had a new lease of literary life as well. Look, before we get into a discussion of 1984 and how he came to write it, would you be kind enough to give perhaps the younger listener a quick reminder of the plot?
Right. So the plot is the story of Winston Smith, who is a fairly ordinary worker in the Ministry of Truth, which is the propaganda department of the Ingsoc regime, which controls Oceania, which is a kind of super state, which basically includes sort of the Americas and Britain. And he's in Airstrip 1, which is we'd normally know as London. And he sort of develops the seed of rebellion, and something sort of occurs to him that sort of this isn't right. And once the resistance sort of starts taking hold in his brain, he sort of becomes rebelling in sort of small ways, like keeping a diary. He sort of has a love affair with another worker at the Ministry of Truth called Julia. And then he sort of decides to trust this guy, O'Brien, who he thinks will connect him with the Brotherhood, which is the kind of the rebel movement. And I should say spoiler warning here, but if it turns out that O'Brien is very much an Ingsoc loyalist and that the whole thing was a setup. And Winston then ends up in the Ministry of Love, which is the torture department, the prison, where he is basically broken down physically and psychologically.
Until he has to accept the assertion that 2 + 2 = 5.
Yes, which is a really symbolic thing to him, and indeed to Orwell in his journalism, that, you know, that freedom is the freedom to say that 2 + 2 = 4. And this was, you know, he was just saying, look, you just start there. Start with being the freedom to say something like a simple arithmetical truth. And if you can't do that, then you can't be free to sort of speak the truth about other things. And therefore, the sort of the victory over him, O'Brien's victory over him, is to make him not just say, but sort of to believe that 2 + 2 = 5, and then finally to love Big Brother.
I'm talking to Dorian Lynskey, author of The Ministry of Truth, a biography of Orwell's 1984. And you kick off the first part of your book with Orwell striding into his editor's office in London, announcing he's going on a trip. And this, you say, was when 1984 began.
I think it did, really, because he had written by this point Down and Out in Paris and London and The Road to Wigan Pier, both very good, important books. He'd also written his first three novels. But this was his decision to go and fight the fascists in Spain and also to write about it.
He's 33, isn't he, at this point?
Yeah, I mean, he's not a young up-and-comer. You know, he spent most of his 20s serving in the Imperial Police Force in Burma, which he loathed, and came back sort of filled with self-loathing, and then had to go and do various things to sort of purge this imperialist guilt he had. And perhaps, you know, part of that guilt as well also led him to go and risk his life fighting fascists in Spain. And he saw some combat, not that much, but what really stuck with him more than the fighting with the fascists was the betrayal by the Soviet-backed forces in the Republic. It gets very, hopefully in the book it's not that complicated, but probably too complicated to explain here, but he was part of a very small, very vulnerable and unpopular left-wing faction that the Stalinists basically accused of collaborating with General Franco's fascists, which was, there was no truth in that at all. It was a complete lie. And Orwell not only saw friends of his arrested and killed based on this lie, but then he saw communist papers in Britain and elsewhere repeating the lie. And so he sort of came back and thought, right, I'm gonna write a book that tells the truth of my experiences. And then his publisher and one of his regular editors both refused to publish anything that he had to say about Spain. And so it was this sort of great betrayal, which he didn't fully articulate until a few years later, where he just realized that the truth was being outrageously distorted and that people who thought they were on the right side were playing along with it. And I think that was what was really shocking, that he kind of fell out with a large section of the left while remaining left wing.
I can't resist reading your description of Orwell's physicality. Quote, he's around 6'3" with size 12 feet, large expressive hands and gangling limbs that he seemed unsure where to place. He had a pale, gaunt, prematurely worn-out face with deep grooves around the mouth, creating an impression of noble suffering that reminded friends of Don Quixote or an El Greco saint. It's interesting, you know, that El Greco saints were based on portraits he did of people he borrowed from the Toledo lunatic asylum. So, okay, so the Spanish War changes him profoundly, and he returns to London and lives through the Blitz. What effect does that have on his writing, Dorian?
Well, I mean, the whole war has an enormous effect on him. You know, before the Blitz starts, basically he's before the war, right up until I think the day of the Nazi-Soviet Pact, he's a pacifist and writes very strongly about how there is no point in fighting in an imperialist war. And then he does a complete U-turn, which he is, you know, he's later he's quite honest about. At the time, perhaps he pretends that he was never a pacifist. And he's just wrestling all the time in his writing with how do you respond? How has this happened? You know, what has happened in Europe in the 1930s? How does one respond? And so he's working his way towards, he's trying out different solutions. And the one that he sort of settles on in his long essay, The Lion and the Unicorn, is this idea of sort of revolutionary patriotism, that you can be a passionate revolutionary socialist and an English patriot who wants to fight Hitler. And so he's sort of, it's sort of a prop, it doesn't read like propaganda, but that was kind of his aim, was to sort of inspire other people, but also to perhaps to resolve this sort of contradiction in his head to his satisfaction. And the weird thing about him is because he was very austere in his tastes and very self-sacrificing, that he quite liked the Blitz. He found it quite exciting. He liked the fact that there was this kind of mood of, you know, of shared sacrifice, you know, kind of dissolved the class boundaries a bit, you know, and he was a sort of an adventure seeker. So he had this sort of strange response to the Blitz.
You are, of course, talking on the ABC, and we are an offshoot of the Reithian BBC. And that reminds us that Orwell gets a job at the Beeb in 1941. Tell me about his radio years.
So he gets his job broadcasting for the Indian section of the Eastern Service, and he's broadcasting a very soft form of propaganda to Indians. As it turns out, really not that many, a few tens of thousands, you know, actually had radio sets. But it was sort of, as opposed to being overt propaganda, it was mostly sort of, you know, arts programs, really, and just sort of expressing ideas of freedom of thought and free culture. And no record of his voice, no recording of his voice survives. Apparently it was so bad that a higher up at the BBC thought that it would embarrass the whole corporation, because anyone who heard it would think that the BBC didn't understand what a good radio voice was. But he was an amazing, so thinking, this was quite early days for a lot of the formats that he was pioneering, that he was doing sort of, you know, poetry discussion programs and short stories and radio plays. You know, not things he invented, but they were a lot of these things, they were really kind of early on, and he had this wonderful imagination. And what he was able to do in the 2 years there, even though he constantly complained about it, he was basically complained about it and said, oh, it's just pointless here. But was also very defensive. If anyone else criticized him, he was like, no, I get to criticize the BBC. You don't get to criticize the BBC. And while working on all of these things, if you actually look at what the talks he was putting out, he was talking about a lot of books and a lot of ideas that came, that sort of fed into 1984. And it's really striking that when he quits towards the end of 1943, he immediately writes an outline for the book that becomes 1984 and starts writing Animal Farm. So he said it was two wasted years, but, you know.
They were anything but wasted. There's so many things that you tell me about him that I didn't know. One of them, life imitating art, he worked under the overall control of the director of talks, Guy Burgess. On August the 18th, he attends an induction course, which a friend of his called the Liars School, and he becomes, of course, very experienced in observing the workings of a large bureaucracy, all of which, of course, feeds into this momentum to write the book.
Yeah, I think one of the mistakes that people do make, and I think the BBC itself does this because it likes to tie itself to Orwell, is that it's often read as the Ministry of Truth is a version of the BBC. And he was well aware, listening to Nazi propaganda and then observing, you know, what's happening at the BBC. He was well aware the BBC was relatively benign. It was certainly not watertight, as we can tell, because Guy Burgess was a spy. It was not there was a room 101 at the BBC, but it was just a meeting room and may have no connection at all. And so what he was really doing was just taking the sort of texture of bureaucratic life, because it was the only time that he really worked in a proper office with lots of colleagues. And so reading 1984, constantly coming across things where it's like, oh, this is sort of based on his local pub. This is sort of based on this flat that he lived in. This detail comes from the BBC, but it's not an allegory. It's not a kind of just a version of that. It was just, he was collecting. He was this astonishing collector of material, both ideas and details and smells and faces.
1984, of course, is described as one of the most famous dystopian novels of all time, but you surprise me that saying Orwell himself would not have seen it as dystopian.
Well, he would have seen it as what we call dystopian, but the word has a really strange history it's coined in 1868, I think, by John Stuart Mill. But then nobody really uses it. They use alternatives like, you know, anti-utopia and negative utopia. And dystopia doesn't really take off until the 50s, the 60s. And now, of course, it's the word. But at the time, Orwell really thought that he was writing an anti-utopia, which is an interesting word, because it does enable you to think, okay, what was he arguing against? What was he anti? And so he drew inspiration from a lot of novels, particularly H.G. Wells. It was like, in order to create his worst version of the future, we had to sort of kick against a lot of these other people with rosier ideas of the future. And in the book, I just try and get into exactly how rich that whole utopian, anti-utopian argument has been for the last 150 years.
Before 1984, before the actual year, I always had the view that Brave New World, which is, as you point out, the two books are awkward literary twins, was even more prescient than Orwell.
It has. I could understand why people were saying that in the 80s, because obviously the Western world had become very wealthy. The Soviet bloc was in decline. And so it seemed that the people would be sort of lulled into passivity rather than tortured into it, rather than beaten into it. But very presciently, that in 1984, the year, Sybil Bedford, who was Huxley's biographer, said, actually, I think the future is going to be a hybrid, that basically, you know, that somebody canny is going to take what they need from the Brave New World model and what they need from the 1984 model. And I think that you can see that in Putin's Russia and in China. You know, they're not these old-fashioned totalitarian states like North Korea is. There's a lot of apparent, you know, there's a pretense of freedom. There's a great deal of pleasure and consumer goods and entertainment. But when necessary, you know, it's the boot in the face, the old-fashioned boot in the face. And so that, I thought one of the things that's really intriguing is that whatever period in time you're writing about 1984, the balance is different. And so the argument in the 80s is not the argument that you'd make now. It's much more a bit of both.
Every generation, every century certainly, has its own Hamlet. And of course you point out that every generation finds its own meaning in 1984. And I suppose that it's painfully obvious why droves of readers are turning to it now. But I made the point in introducing you that all can be appropriated by either the left or the right.
And many shades within them. I mean, I think I found that basically the only people that weren't at one point, the Stalinist left did not try and appropriate him. They were very clear that he was not on their side. But almost everybody else did, you know, from sort of real like McCarthyite right wingers to student radicals and the Black Panthers. And now it's a free for all, and you end up with this bizarre situation of just seeing quotes flying around without any context, and often, in fact, quotes that don't even appear in the book. It's a very misremembered book. The word doublespeak, which we're pretty familiar with, is not in the book. It's often used to just describe the way that politicians lie. And it's like, well, he didn't make that up. That just is how that was made up by people misremembering him. So there's something obviously very rich and engaging about this sort of, about this text, that it can be used in all these different ways. But I felt for me in this book that it was really important to say, well, this is what Orwell thought. This is what Orwell intended. And it's not mysterious what he intended. And I think there are certain cases where he would be pretty alarmed to see it being taken by his sort of political opponents.
You make the extraordinary assertion that the Ministry of Truth these days is Facebook, Google, and Alexa.
I think that might be a line from a review of the book. I don't think that's my assertion, but it's certainly, I suppose I worry about being alarmist. I think that's the thing. When people say, is the world like 1984? And it's like, well, no, because the whole point of 1984 is that it's so bad that there is no room to escape. And so, you know, if you can basically read 1984 and talk about 1984 on the radio, then you're relatively safe so far. But I suppose it's that technology, in terms of the collection of data, in terms of surveillance, in terms of the way that data can be used to sort of almost read your mind and predict what you want, that's something that we would find very alarming. I find alarming. I've certainly become more wary of this stuff from writing the book, because it just does make you think twice about, like, what do people know about me? Who's watching me? What are they going to use it for? And you don't want to end up wildly paranoid. But I think the speed of change of technology is something that we have not really equipped to keep up with. And I think if the book can help people think twice, that, you know, about things that Orwell could never have predicted, you know, devices he could never have predicted, that's a valuable service for a book that's 70 years old.
I believe Orwell himself once said that 1984 wouldn't have been so gloomy had he not been so ill while he was writing it. But you don't believe that the book is entirely symptomatic of his travails?
No, and that's an interesting quote, because it only appeared after he died, so he couldn't basically confirm whether or not he'd said it. It was just a friend saying that he remembered him saying it. And what I found was that, for one thing, Orwell could be pretty gloomy at the best of times. You know, he could be quite the pessimist. And two, he was sort of filled with, and he was filled with a sort of burning desire to finish it, and a love of life, that while he was writing this book, and you get this image of him being very lonely on his Scottish island, you know, he was raising a son. He was gardening and lobster fishing and hunting rabbits.
But he was also mourning the loss of his wife, wasn't he, Eileen?
No, that's true. She died towards the end of the war. So there was a strange combination of things that were happening in his own life, things that were happening in his own body, things that were happening in the world. And I just thought, I certainly came to the conclusion that it's like, even had his TB cleared up, 1984, which was a book he'd been thinking about for many years, which it was always going to end this way. In fact, in the outline he wrote in 1943, this is the ending is emotionally is the same. It was always going to end badly. So I don't know. I think his illness more affected the kind of the strange texture of the book, that kind of slightly hallucinatory, nightmarish quality, which is something obviously you get if you're often if you're chronically ill and having fevers.
I didn't realise that his TB was effectively undiagnosed.
It's a tricky one to sort of pin down, because I think that certainly his late brother-in-law, who Eileen's brother, who died at Dunkirk, had sort of suggested that he did have TB. But then it didn't seem to be kind of formally diagnosed until some years later. Now, whether that made the difference, or whether it was the fact that he decided to, you know, stay away from medical care to finish his book and sort of enjoy his life on the island as long as he could, or just because the medication didn't work. There's a sense of, I suppose also I'd always grown up with this idea that Orwell was doomed. And of course, when you actually look into someone's life, you realize it's always, there's all these contingencies. Like he might have lived. And I suppose that makes it more tragic that it wasn't this kind of irreversible decline. It could have been stopped here and there.
We return to the fact that the book's been misread and misinterpreted, and the misreading begins shortly after its publication, you point out. The struggle to claim 1984 began immediately with a battle over its meaning.
Yes, which led him within a couple of weeks to issue these two press statements going, I'm not anti-socialist, I'm not anti-Labour. You know, he supported Clement Attlee's Labour government. I'm not saying that this is like, it's not a simple, what it was becoming, which was like a Cold War weapon. And he was going, no, this is specifically about totalitarianism. And that's the important bit, not socialism, is the totalitarianism is the problem, and that something like that could happen somewhere else. And he hypothesizes this phrase 100% Americanism. He says, well, that could be a form of totalitarianism. And that's another one of those things where you think, oh, okay, that's familiar.
It's pretty clever to write a book which is held up as a warning about the perils of imperialism, capitalism, socialism, fascism, a book that will be lauded by the John Birch Society and the Black Panthers.
I said, because what it's about, really, is it's about human nature more than it's about systems. It's about power, and it's about how humans try and exert power over each other, and the lies and moral compromises and crimes that they will commit in order to achieve and maintain power. And so almost from whichever angle you're coming from, unless you're literally running a totalitarian regime yourself, 1984 sort of seems to speak to you. So it's not, in a way, the flexibility, is a compliment to it, that the fact that it could be misinterpreted, because it's saying it's not pinned down to a single ideology, and it's just going, you know, watch out, this is what humans will do, or certain humans will do, given the chance. And I think that's why its relevance changes over the years, and it's really spiked at the moment, because we're seeing the seeds of really sort of terrible regimes, and we're not there yet, or maybe even close yet. But now everybody's thinking about, oh, how did they start? How did this happen? And that goes back to what I was saying about why Orwell wanted to write the book in the first place. It was like, how did this happen? And how did people let it happen? Because it's not just a small, powerful force that takes over. It requires a lot of people in the public to endorse it.
Dorian, thank you enormously for coming on the program. Dorian Lynskey's book, The Ministry of Truth, a biography of George Orwell's 1984, has just been published by Picador. And as I said at the outset, the reviews are incandescently enthusiastic.